Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the Toy Department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah.
All right, we're back after a little hiatus. 1 week off of the toy department. Because, Kolsky, you're doing a medical thing, so I guess we should start with how you're feeling.
Good. it depends. Do we want to play this funny or straight ahead? If we're playing straight ahead, I have lived my entire life with an inability to breathe freely through my nose, and I'm not fully healed, but I'm breathing better than I ever have in my entire life, which is pretty exciting. If we're going to go funny, I had a nose job.
Gotcha. I was definitely going to make up the part of the anatomy that you were working on, and it was not going to be your nose.
if you know what I mean.
But yes, congratulations on your rhinoplasty.
Thank you. Yeah, look good, feel good, you know?
I actually had the same procedure that you had many years ago, and it did nothing for me. I'm exactly the same as I am today. So
I feel terrible for you about that, because it really, like, I was worried. You worried me a little bit by telling me that before the surgery. And, you know, you wake up with your nose filled with scar tissue and scabbing and whatnot. You can't breathe at all for a couple days, and, like, there's some terror in there. But once the healing was underway, it was pretty clear to me that there's a major upgrade. And I think once I'm fully healthy, it's going to be pretty awesome.
All right. Well, we're going to talk more about scarring and scab tissue on this week's Toy Department. No, I'm kidding. We're going to talk
about that. I was wondering where you were going with that.
We're going to talk about the Andre the Giant documentary that we had left over for homework from a while ago. The new show on BBC America, Killing Eve. The new Unknown Mortal Orchestra record. And probably some NBA playoffs. But let's start with the big return, the big television return last night of Westworld. Now, Kolsky, refresh my memory. Like, where were you? Where are you at on Westworld headed into season two?
Maybe a better question is, where was I at on Westworld headed into the season one finale? Because I think the answer to that is, eh. You know, it's a show that I think we both admired the acting and thought there was some interesting stuff going on, but I didn't love the first season, and then the finale really brought me back in. Like, it was, I just thought the first season was slow. There was a little too much of, like, ha ha ha, what a mystery, what's happening here, and not enough actual plot. And then the finale sort of turned everything on its head and exploded the reality, and it really sucked me in. And I gotta say, after one episode of season two, I've gone about as far back in the other direction as I could have imagined.
See, now I'm in a slightly different place, I think, than you were at that point at the end of season one. I too was pretty just sort of eh on the show, and I remember liking the finale, but I also remember thinking that, like, they sort of missed an off ramp that I thought a bit could have been a more interesting a world to them, which would have been the Tandy Newton character actually wandering through the real world.
Yeah, actually exiting into the real world. And
yeah.
And also, by the way, okay, so slight spoilers here. The season two premiere is shot in multiple timelines, it seems. And they do give you, like, the impression that maybe her leaving was actually some overlord's plan all along.
Yeah.
I don't know. They come back in season two, and after I felt like sort of focusing in the finale into what could have been some interesting stuff, they just spread all out again and went so broad, and it's just hard for me to care.
Yeah. It's really hard for me to care, and I'm totally with you that it just sort of sucked me back into that, like, I don't know why. I think felt like my esteem for the show had grown in its time away.
I think so too. I think mine too.
Because I was pretty excited for this, and then it comes on, and I'm like, "Oh yeah, this show is kind of just okay. Like, there's some good things, but man, it is ponderous at times." And I have really forgotten about the writing and how much I like don't like a lot of the writing and any of the like the philosophical treatises about what it means to be real and existence. Like, anytime they're doing any of that, it's just all the eye rolls for me. And there's a lot of that. You know what I mean?
There's a ton of that. And I'm curious, do you think that is because you're uninterested in that as a, like, conceptually, or because it's not executed that well?
It's definitely the latter, because I am interested in that as a concept.
Totally agree. Like, I am interested in meditation. You know, philosophically speaking, meditations on what is real in America in 2018, I think, are relevant and interesting. And they just, I feel, are like ham-handing it in some of the worst ways. It's not. It's like they're not actually exploring the philosophical question. They're just asking the philosophical question over and over and over again.
Yeah, the thing, the road I wrote for my notes was hacky, you know, and it just feels a little hacky. And like the show, it gives you the impression that the show is about half as clever as it thinks that it is sometimes, you know.
Uh-huh. Absolutely, and I will say that, you know, you said there's some good things, and I think that. We said this in season one, too. The good things primarily are the acting. There are some really great performances here. Jeffrey Wright, Ed Harris. Is it Evan Rachel Wood?
Evan Rachel Wood. I'm all in for Tandy Newton. I think
she's brilliant. Phenomenal. Yeah. I think Tandy Newton, by the way, Tandy Newton was my favorite actress in the world after Mission Impossible 3, and I don't totally know what went wrong.
I've always loved her in the Mission Impossible stuff. Yeah, always. I don't know.
Oh, man. She was great in that. And I don't know. I don't know why she isn't a bigger superstar, but I think she's shown throughout the course of, you know, 11 episodes or whatever, that her chops are A1. She's fantastic, and the way she plays that character is one of the only of all the. And I think this is more writing than acting, but of all the sort of what's it mean to be a computer person versus a real person? Like, she actually seems to play that with more subtlety to me than anyone.
Yeah.
So I agree. I'm a huge fan of hers.
I mean, Jeffrey Wright, I think, does that too pretty well.
He does. Yeah. But his and again, I think this comes back to the writing. His character is so obnoxiously put upon and, you know, fretful that, like, I get lost with that sometimes. But in general, the acting is phenomenal. It's just that I don't feel like they've got a ton to work with, unfortunately.
Yeah, I agree. I agree the Evan Rachel Wood performance on balance is pretty good. But like that scene where she's about to hang those executives and she's giving this speech, and I was just
It was like 7
oh.
minutes of trash. It really was.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like I can't fast forward this, but man, do I really want to.
And by the way, like, with a lot of the scenes, that's a great example of it, but it happens fairly frequently in even just in this one episode that you're like, she's going to kill these people and I don't care.
Nope.
And she doesn't seem to care. And I don't understand why we're watching this.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of not caring. So,
you know, it's interesting at this point. I feel like I'm watching it for the culture because it's such a thing in the culture, and I like want to be in on that conversation, but I didn't love it. And I spent a lot of the time being like, this is how I felt last year, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree. And now I'm starting to feel like there's enough of a body of work that I'm, you know, I think to me, it's like, all right, you had a rocky first season and maybe the show is really going to find itself in its second because there's the bones of like a great television show in there somewhere.
Right.
And now I'm less hopeful about that than maybe I was before. We talked about this a little bit last night when you and I were kind of texting back and forth. I sort of feel like, you know, Westworld seems to be the current crown jewel. You know what I mean? In the shows that are airing right now of sort of the HBO stable of things.
Yeah, I mean, you're just saying that because Game of Thrones is off.
Yeah. I'm thinking because Game of Thrones is off the air. But it's probably right. Their second most buzzy show after that, I would think, no?
It probably is their second most buzzy, but it is not their second best.
No, no, it's definitely not their, definitely not their second best. But I'm looking around at Sunday Night HBO, which, you know, has been the gold standard for as long as you can remember. And, you know, we've talked about this season in Silicon Valley. So it sort of feels like they're entering their later period entourage phase.
Yes, although I will say I am still incredibly entertained by that show.
I still watch it every week, and it's a better show than Entourage was. I'm not trying to say that it's the same thing, but I am trying to say
it's much better than Entourage. Yeah. But also, Zach Wood's performance on that show is so good and so funny that I have much less of the late season Entourage feeling, you know, six episodes or whatever in than I did at the beginning.
All right, well, that's good. You know, Barry, we I think both like.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But it's not like, are you running out and telling people like, oh my God, you got to see Barry?
Nope.
No.
No, in fact, it's funny. This is sort of a side note, but I noticed the other day what I've been running out and telling people lately is to watch a bunch of documentaries.
Yeah, that's true. It really is a lot of docs. But I look at, and we've had some version of this conversation before, but I look at how many of my favorite things to watch are on FX right now. And, you know, you've got Atlanta, which is, you know, is the king of the hill at the moment in terms of television quality.
Agreed.
Start there. I think we are both really loving Trust and continue to love Trust. We talk often about Legion.
Yep.
I'm not going to subject you to any more than saying I am riding really hard for this season of The Americans. You know, I get it. You're out. It's fine.
No comment.
But it's back. That's all I'm saying. It's back, and it's bad, and I can't wait to see how it ends.
Because people, even the people who loved it, didn't love last year. Right?
Yeah, last year was a step back. It was, you know, it's. I have a feeling that people will sort of look back on season, I believe it's five of The Americans, the way that people sort of do season two of The Wire. You know what I mean?
Well, people are wrong about that, but okay.
Yeah, people are wrong about that, but I'm just saying that in terms of the popular conversation, I happen to love season two of The Wire. The last season of The Wire is clearly the weakest to me.
I probably agree with that, but it's choosing between various diamond
you're
cuts.
Right. It's also still really good. My point is, it's. I feel like it's a blip in the overall quality of the show.
Yeah, I hear you. People love it. Great.
Yeah, adventurous show. That to me, and that's before, you know, they're doing other stuff. I didn't mention all the things.
Legion?
I think I mentioned Legion, but Legion definitely is in that group, and obviously we talk about that show and love that show a lot. Like, I feel like that's a much better stable than what's going on HBO right now.
And you didn't even mention any of their comedies.
Nope, I didn't.
All of which we enjoy. So I would agree.
Or any of the Ryan Murphy Empire, which I think a lot of people really enjoy. Probably some of the more popular shows on FX, actually.
Very true. I don't think there's any question that right now, if I'm power ranking TV stations lineups, FX is number one with a bullet.
Yeah, like if we're moving to that over the top world where you sort of have to pay individually to have the rights to watch each channel, like I'm buying FX first, I think, right?
Yes, because I'm not the reason to buy right now. This takes us back to like the 90s, but right now the reason to buy HBO in that sort of imagined scenario over FX would be to have their movie library, and with Netflix and stuff, you don't need it.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. FX, by the way, has a pretty strong movie library too. I don't know if online if you get those without commercials or not. I have FX online, and I don't ever watch it because I'm old school and I still have cable. So,
DVR takes care of the commercials. But either way, in terms of original shows, I don't think anyone's close to FX right now.
Yeah, I mean, they seem to be in a plane of their own, but I don't think that they get talked about the way that HBO or Netflix does.
Maybe we should be fair. It may be that Netflix is up there with FX.
Yeah, although, I mean, look, obviously, it's a different story in that you're just going to have more quantity on Netflix.
Yes.
But I will take the highs of FX over the highs of Netflix.
I think that's probably true, although, Gosh, I love some of the Netflix originals. I mean, I'm a huge, huge fan of Glow, as I think we've discussed repeatedly. Yeah. And even going backwards, Orange is the New Black still entertains me. There's a lot of little
I
things on
Love,
Netflix.
Particularly the last season of Love, I think.
Love, Easy. I mean, the documentary we spent a few weeks talking about, Wild Wild Country. And that is, I think, if we're trying to suss out how Netflix gets close to FX, it's because they have the ability to do things like Wild Wild Country. But in terms of TV stations that actually still have a number on your cable lineup, FX is far ahead, I would say.
Yeah, I agree. All right, well, HBO put their hand back into the documentary world. Not that they've never really left the documentary world. but with the recent airing of Andre the Giant. Was it called Andre the Giant, the documentary, or does it have some other
name? No, I think it's called Andre the Giant.
This was a really enjoyable hour and a half or so of television, I thought.
Yeah.
In the, you know, we talked about the Ric Flair documentary, 30 for 30, I guess, when that came out. This was a step up from that, I thought.
Yes, but I think it had room to be better. I don't know. I hate to be the guy who comes out nitpicking about something I pretty much enjoyed. I thought it suffered from some of the same things that the Ric Flair documentary did in terms of sort of leaving out some stuff. And, you know, part of that is just time and reasonable decisions. But I did think there was some strange choices in terms of time spent on certain things.
What do you think was left out? I'm curious.
There was just a lot of Hulk. And I understand that the Hulk thing is an intimate part of understanding the changes wrestling was going through and all that. Mm-hmm. But I thought probably it felt like there were 20 minutes of Hulk stuff where Andre was shunted off to the side, and there could have been 10 or 15, maybe something like that.
It's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think it's, if you're telling the story of Andre being part of uniting the territories of wrestling, you know, it's sort of hard to tell that story without Hulk Hogan. You know what I mean? Cause he's also such
right.
a huge part of that. Yeah.
Right. But, I will say it's really good. And I think this is a case where the story is with Ric Flair, it felt like this is a good doc, an enjoyable doc, and a good story, but it's not the best story and it's not the best doc.
Yeah.
This one to me felt like this is a good doc and an incredible story. It is the best story, but it's not the best doc.
Yeah, I do feel like it pulled fewer punches than the Flair one. The Flair, you know, we talked a lot about how there wasn't kind of the necessarily the reckoning for him. And I
right.
also think it sort of left out, you know, this whole Hogan-Andre territorial phenomenon that Flair like kind of wasn't really a part of, even though he was generally considered the best. You know,
right.
he didn't get over to WWE yeah. until sort of after his prime years. And that's not really examined all that much either. Whereas, you know, Andre, I mean, I guess there are some of the legendary drinking stuff left off the table and a couple other things.
Yeah, not apocryphal. What's the word I'm looking for? Like some, you know, the stuff of legends, some sort of tall tales.
Yeah.
That they left out because I think they couldn't really get to the veracity of them. But would have been interesting to hear anyway in like a sort of the Legend of Andre section, maybe.
Yeah,
I think.
Like why don't it include hey, here's some things that we don't know are true, but that people actually said. I think that would have some value. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah. Yup. That's part of it. And I don't know that they, for me, dug deep enough into the what I would call the Michael Jordan question of Andre the Giant, which is, does Andre simply coincide timing-wise with this massive change in the way the world works? Was he lucky to come around timing-wise at that time, or is he the driver of change?
Yeah, I think it's some of both. And I think, too, the other thing that I would like to know and I think it's just a function of having a subject who's no longer with us, is I'd like to know a little bit more about how he felt about medical treatment. You know what I mean?
Yep. On like a deeper level. Yeah, because they don't explain why he wouldn't get healthy.
Yeah. And I don't, but yeah, I don't think you can do that without actually talking to Andrei Rusimov. You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, that's obviously part of the issue here is the opposite issue from Ric Flair, which is with Ric Flair, it's like, all right, well, this guy's here, but you can't trust him necessarily. With Andre, he's not here, so we don't know. But all this is a lot of nitpicking because generally I thought it was really enjoyable and a very good documentary. And there's a few things that just scream out to me from this as incredible. And one, of course, and obviously this is done on purpose for good reason, is his mass. The mass of that man is consistently staggering.
Yeah.
Every time he's on the screen, the hands, just the size. And look, like was Andre the Giant bigger than what Shaq is right now? I'm not sure that he was.
He was, but they're pretty similar. They're pretty similar.
But it's close. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And yet somehow, as huge as Shaq is, and as much as he dwarfs people, and part of this is he travels in professional basketball circles, so there's more tall guys around, but just the constant juxtaposition of Andre with other people, with normal-sized people, it you never stop being amazed by the sheer mass of that man.
Yeah.
And that really did come through as to like why he was such a phenomenon that in a world where there was no internet and you couldn't Google biggest people in the world and like photographs just didn't circulate the way they do now. The amazement people felt seeing that guy totally came through in the documentary. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. I mean, I watched, you know, I would say my formative years with wrestling, and I was really big into wrestling up until probably about 14, you know what I mean? From like age, I don't know, mm-hmm. 7 to 14. Like,
yep.
There was a point I actually added up how many hours of wrestling I watched in a week, and it was well over 20. It was probably, may have been 30.
That's a lot.
It was a lot. It was a lot. I watched a lot of wrestling. But like, that all started with like WrestleMania 2 and then Andre main event at WrestleMania 3. So like, this guy was a formative part of my childhood, and so I was really there for all this. But even I had lost touch with just sort of the sheer scale of the man and kind of the awe of it all. And it was wild to watch footage of that Hogan match with people sort of explaining, like, here's how hurt he was, and here's the
right.
And you can see it, and you realize you didn't notice any of that back then. And you know what? Like, look. I think we all have our issues with Hulk Hogan as a figure and a human being.
Sure.
But him taking you through that match as an insight, like, that was riveting. Like,
I could watch that all day. Yeah, that's another thing I'd say in general about this documentary, that there's a lot of complicated people on screen throughout it. Vince McMahon, Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, people that I think most of us would have complicated feelings about if we really dig into it. And they are all turned to children in a variety of ways talking about Andre.
Yeah.
The awe of him, the respect for him, the sadness that they all feel knowing what he was going through and knowing that I mean, I think maybe the biggest takeaway is that a man who was essentially dying from the time he was 30-something was out there putting everybody on as a wrestler, and just while he was capable of being frightening, was also, it seems, a caring man who those relationships he had were important to him. And you know, they talk all the time about how he spoke physically more than verbally, and you understand that. You really come to understand that through the documentary. The other thing that's interesting to me, well, a couple more things, but one sort of side note is my dad had acromegaly.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, after he was done growing. I don't know exactly how the disease works. I think you kind of have it or don't. So I guess you always kind of have it, but it didn't kick in for him until he was done growing for the most part. So he didn't grow super tall, and they caught it early, so it was treated and not a big issue. But his hands sort of knobbed out a little bit, for lack of a better description. His face took on very slight parts of that acromegaly look before it was treated. So I have a little bit of familiarity with that disease, and it really is horrible. And the pain associated with it is a big, big, big deal. So it was interesting to me, and I think they did a great job of talking about how tough it was for him physically his whole life. And probably I thought the most poignant stuff you got out of the mouth of Andre himself was when he talked about how, you know, there's no accommodations made for giants.
Yeah.
Deaf people, blind people, like, I mean, look, they're all unfortunate handicaps, and I think we could probably do better to support people with all of those handicaps, but we don't think of being super big as a handicap, and no one is helping. So here's a guy who can't sit in a chair, who can't walk in a doorway, who can't fly on a plane normally. And just like how hard it must have been, and also the point of like can't go anywhere.
Right. Living a life that depended completely on like travel from place to place all the time.
Yeah, and can't go outside, and it can't hide at all. You know, I mean, Steph Curry is one of the most famous people in the world, but sunglasses and a hoodie, and you might not notice him.
Right. Ironically, they lived about 30 miles apart.
Yeah. And then the last thing that really hits home with this is the world is so different, man.
Yeah.
It's just a phenomenon like this could never happen today. Wrestling could never happen today in the way it did back then. And if wrestling hadn't become entrenched with this group of people who accept the fact that it's scripted and don't care, like, it's just you couldn't start that phenomenon today because nobody would believe it was real for a second. It would be exposed within minutes.
Yep. This documentary, I think, really could have easily just sort of been funny stories and like, you know, talking about Andre not liking Randy Savage and pictures of him with seven women. And that would have been plenty enjoyable. I enjoyed all those things. But I really like that it went deeper in a way that stayed with you. And I think that's kudos to the people making the film.
Yeah, I agree with almost all of that.
All right, so should we turn our attention to Killing Eve?
I think we better.
Yeah, something that you were very high on. Now, I watched the first episode of Killing Eve, and we talked about it, and I was not super into it. Uh-huh. But I think the second episode, I thought it really picked up.
Oh, then you'll like the third episode even more.
I will say, you know, and some people I think have enjoyed this. I find the... And Eve, the assassin, is a really fascinating character. You know what I mean?
The assassin is not Eve.
Or,
yes.
Sorry, rather. Yes, excuse me. Eve is Sandra Oh, correct?
Right, yeah. Right.
The assassin's a fascinating character. But, like, this show's really flippant about, like, murder. You know what
yes.
I mean?
Yes.
In a way that I don't know. Like, I think I get why you like it. I never actually watch any of these John Wick things, but I sort of imagine that it's kind of a lot of that vibe. Am I not far off on that?
This show is doing a lot more than John Wick.
Yeah, I'm not saying overall. I just mean the violence,
the casual violence,
the casual
yeah.
violence.
Perhaps
yes.
that's a similarity. Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of what I mean by that.
I think, but you know, you mentioned earlier, Barry is another show that is deep in casual violence right now.
Yeah.
I think there is part of me that wonders if this sort of movement towards casual violence is just a product of, you know, this is what the video games and action movies have really done. It's not that they're causing kids to shoot up schools. It's that they're causing us to be inured to violence, and therefore our artists to be inured to violence and to kind of just throw it in willy-nilly.
Yeah, I mean, I think of like a movie like Atomic Blonde, Yes. Is another one kind of in that vein where it's exactly. It's just a lot of like, oh, isn't this fun? I'm going to stab this person in the eye, you know?
Yeah, there is some eye stabbing here, but I do think this show, unlike those movies, does try to process it. And I think as time goes on, I think Jodie Comer, I believe is her name, who I think is brilliant as the assassin.
What is her Sandra name, the assassin?
What's that?
What is her name, the assassin?
I don't know that we have a real name for her, do we? Let me see if there's a character name on IMDb. But she's, I don't know, she's got like Villanelle is the name she's given on
Also, is it explained why Sandra Oh works for MI5 and 6, but it seems to be wholly American?
Oh, yeah. She explains at one point that I think you've seen that, but she says, I was born in Britain. My dad was British. My mom was American. I was raised in America, but I moved back here at some point.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. I guess I just missed that.
First of all, she's brilliant. Sandra Oh lights up the screen. She's funny. She's clever. She's just an incredibly endearing main character. And she's also sort of the avatar for processing the violence in some way, I think. And she has this... I think she in some ways emotionally represents the audience, right? That, like, we are aware that this... assassin is a vile killer, but also
she's also quite
enchanted.
Yeah, she's quite titillated by all of it.
Yes, and I think that's sort of how I feel, and watching Sandra Oh act out my feelings is delightful. I'm having a ton of fun with this show, and I just think everyone in it is fun and exciting, and man, some unexpected stuff happens and continues to do so through the third episode.
All right. Well, the third episode obviously it's starting to set up an interesting cat and mouse game for sure.
Right. At least, I think maybe, and if I had to analyze without discussing it deeply why you are more into it after episode two, it's because episode one does a lot of groundwork laying, and it's like it feels like maybe we're going to have six people in a room doing CSI stuff while an assassin's running around and not a lot of interaction. But episode two starts to take us out into the field and actually pit these characters against each other. And I think it's going to continue to move in that direction.
Yeah. And I do think that's a more interesting show. I definitely got the sense of like, oh, okay, well, this is going to be a different show than maybe I realized, which I can appreciate. So I would say, I would give a thumbs up to the show, and I think it sounds like you were like an enthusiastic thumbs up.
Very much so. Here are the things that I wrote down that we have not mentioned. I don't know why I wrote this down, because this is from episode one and it's about 2 weeks old, but do you remember a scene with Bruschetta? I don't know what this is about. I'm not even sure I'm reading it right. I should take notes on a computer. Here are the more important things I wrote down. Sandra Oh's charm is undeniable. She's just phenomenal. And Fiona Shaw, who you may know as Mrs. Dursley from Harry Potter, or...
I don't, because I've never seen a Harry Potter.
Oh, wow. Did you watch True Blood?
I did watch True Blood, yeah.
Okay, so you may remember her from True Blood, but Fiona Shaw, the sort of... super secret MI6 agent who's orchestrating the whole thing, is given a rare sort of delight, I think, for her, because she's played a lot of weird old lady characters, and now she's sort of this shadowy figure who seems to have incredible clout and savvy, and is like, you just get the feeling she's one of those important people in the fight for good sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But she's clearly having so much fun getting to play this part opposite Sandra Oh. And I love the scenes where they go back and forth.
I do too. I liked her. I think it's interesting that you have someone who's in this show and Barry. So
yeah.
a lot of casual violence there. I will say, and I feel bad because I already said I wasn't going to talk about this. But I do think that it's hard not to see some parallels between this show and what Kerry Russell's doing on The Americans, and I think that's just much more my speed, that show, which I think takes a lot of time to sort of examine. It's a lot less it's nearly as violent, but a lot less casual about it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. I think that speaks directly to our differing tastes. I'm totally cool with the casual violence, and I'm down to have fun around it. And if they choose not to examine it philosophically, I'm cool with that.
Yeah. Because, I think both characters do make a lot of the similar kinds of decisions, but they definitely feel like wildly different shows. So,
on a side note, before we move on.
Didn't even really think about that.
Before we move on from Killing Eve quickly, we should mention the creator, the writer, is Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who has become something of a low-key sensation. She's got a whole bunch of shows active in various countries and places at the moment, and I think she's pretty brilliant. So one thing my enjoyment of Killing Eve led to was me checking out a show of hers that's on Netflix right now called Crashing.
Hmm.
Which, yes, is the same title as a Pete Holmes show, but very different. It's about a bunch of British, I would say 20-somethings, living in an abandoned hospital. And I would love for you to watch a couple episodes of that for next week. It's very bizarre and quirky, but I think pretty enjoyable.
Did you watch Broadchurch? I guess she's in Broadchurch as well.
She is also in Broadchurch. I've never watched that.
I've heard that's great. The British version, anyway, I've heard it's great.
Yeah, that also, I think, is on Netflix if people are interested, but... let's put Crashing, the British version, on Netflix in the queue if we can.
Okay. I think we can do that. All right. Should we talk some music?
Yeah.
I got a couple things to talk about. I guess we can start with the Unknown Mortal Orchestra album.
Okay.
Which you recommended.
Can I ask, have you listened to an Unknown Mortal Orchestra album before?
No.
Okay. For a brief preamble, I think we're 4 or 5 albums in at this point. I'm a huge fan. This is one of my favorite bands, and that's why I had you listen to it. Their last album was called Multilove and was, I think, a pretty big break for them popularity-wise. I think it – they.
Sorry, this is that? Their fourth album.
Fourth. Okay, yeah. I was close. And the third one, Multilove, is – it was the one that went from sort of a little-known indie psych rock band to somewhat more well-known indie psych rock band. And it their early stuff is very guitar-driven, sort of airy psych rock. That album turned in a few more catchy, poppy sort of versions of psych rock, and this probably moves even further in that direction, although there's certainly some weird stuff on this album. But I don't know that this is their best album. I do think it's good, and I did really enjoy it.
It's interesting that you say that this is one of your favorite bands, because one of the things I remember thinking was it's not that it's I don't think it's bad. I liked a lot of it. I thought it was a little hit and miss, this record.
Yeah, that's sort of what I'm saying. Yeah. I think their third record is more hit.
But I actually remember thinking to myself, like, it's hard for me to imagine being really excited about these guys. And apparently,
well, part of it is their live show is phenomenal. They have the guitarist Ruben Nielsen, who's the sort of auteur of the band, is a brilliant and really interesting guitar player. I think it's in a way that you would enjoy it, not in like a fishy, let's get all out there and jam out sort of a way, but just in a like capable band driver and soloist when needed. And he's super engaging, and they also have a drummer who's just out of this world, which makes the live experience especially exciting for me. So that's part of it. But also, like, I really do enjoy this brand of sort of indie psych rock, where it's definitely pop formatted songs, but they're a little more musically interesting than your average pop rock, or it's sort of indie pop rock. And I don't know, it speaks to me very directly for some reason.
I'm going to say this, and I think it's going to sound worse than maybe I intend it to. They just strike me as a less adventurous Tame Impala.
Oh, I would say they're equally adventurous, although less maybe
less talented. I don't know. But like again, that's I really like Tame Impala.
Right.
And I really like them live.
I prefer Unknown Mortal Orchestra to Tame Impala, but I see the parallel that you're drawing. And yeah, I would say they're definitely the same genre. I would say Tame Impala does more like ambient exploration, if you will,
mm-hmm.
Where Unknown Mortal Orchestra fits a little more comfortably into like, again, it's not pop music, but it's pop packaging, if you will.
Although when Tame Impala wants to wriggle itself into pop packaging, I think they're very effective at it.
Yeah, no, I'm not dissing Tame Impala. Yeah. But I think the song, it's interesting that you prefer them because I do think the like,
they're weirder, right?
They're weirder, yeah. And the pop song craft of Unknown Mortal Orchestra is at a higher level.
I feel like Tame Impala is weirder and poppier at the same time, which is kind of why I said they're less interesting.
That's interesting because I think, I wonder, we don't have to do it for the podcast, but personally I would be interested to hear what you'd say about their earlier albums because I think, again, this one was more hit and miss than some of the others. And
I have a feeling I would like their earlier albums better from the way that you described them because I think the parts in Sex and Food that work are when they really lock into a really cool guitar groove.
It sounds like the
earlier works have more of that stuff.
I mean, I think even if you went to the three or four singles off of Multilove, which are Multilove and Can't Keep Checking My Phone, I feel like these were reasonably big songs. I'm surprised that you haven't heard them before. But those and then their first single, which is So Good at Being in Trouble, which is like a real low-key sort of, again, indie psych rock jam, but it hits just a beautiful guitar groove. That's where they are at their best. You're absolutely right. When you get that sort of swinging guitar groove within a pop format with like psych rock elements, and I just find it really interesting.
I would definitely want to check out some of their earlier stuff. And I think we did well here. I wouldn't say I disliked this, but I wasn't in love either. You know what I mean?
But I like that you saw the promise, and I feel like this is a better result than most of my musical recommendations.
I guess that's true.
You know, it's all relative, man. We gotta judge on a curve.
All right. So speaking of all relative, I want to have this conversation. If you follow me on Twitter at all, you maybe heard me talking about this a little bit. I have a frustration.
I don't believe you.
And I think I know. And I think we've. I think we've maybe even addressed this frustration before, but it's the way that we talk about Beyoncé. And
uh-oh.
I'm not here to tell you that Beyoncé is not good.
You better not be.
Of course. Like, I think Beyoncé is quite good. She's really good. You know, like, let's establish that as fact. But I also think, and I'm just thinking about the reviews of this Coachella set, which you've seen. I have not seen.
Yeah, I watched.
Again,
Coachella
not my fault,
because
Beyoncé
did
a really good job, I think, of getting the buzz out there and then making it completely unavailable.
I actually was going to say the opposite. They not only did it stream live, but I watched it the next day.
Yeah, it streamed live. I tried to watch it the next day. It was unavailable, and then they started clamping down and then did not stream the second set live at all. So that's kind of what I mean.
I don't think any of the second weekend was streamed.
The second weekend was streamed except hers.
So, oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that. That's interesting.
So,
well, I saw it, and I loved it. So I don't know what the hell your problem is.
My problem is not whether or not it was good. Obviously, I don't know whether or not it was good. I don't doubt whether it was. It sounded great. Like
it was.
But like, my problem is that we have entered this like zone with Beyoncé that like very few people reach. I think maybe like Oprah's kind of in that zone. Maybe there are a couple of other people where like she can only be discussed in the most breathless of terms. You know, everything is Beyoncé just delivered the greatest performance in the history of Coachella.
Well, okay,
it's Beychella 2018. And you're like that's it. Like, oh my God, Beyoncé did a thing and we have to talk about it. And like, again, not taken away from the thing that she did at all. I just feel like we've completely lost any ability to discuss her in any critical way at all. Like, you can't even say, well, that was really good, but what about this? Like, that's not a part of our dialogue anymore. It's nothing but, oh my God, Queen Bee. And for me, that's kind of a turnoff.
I understand that because, as we all know, I hate nothing more than overrated things. But I don't think she's overrated.
I do. I think she's now crossed over into overrated. I think she's really good. But I don't think there's a single person in the history of music who is as good as we talk about Beyonce right now. Michael Jackson, Marvin Gaye, Prince, Bob Marley. None of those people are as good as the way we treat Beyonce.
That was a good Mount Rushmore you just reeled off, first of all. Second of all, I think Prince is as good as we talk about Beyonce. Okay. But also, I think, by the way,
I say this recognizing fully that none of this is Bey's fault. Like, she didn't do this. This is all about how we are about her.
Yes. Well, okay. I think, first of all, I think it's more about the world than Beyonce. Like, I think it's just the chorus of the Beehive is so loud because of the world we live in with social media and whatnot, and because the Beyonce stands, I think there's a huge overlap in the Venn diagram of Beyonce stands and loud social media voices
and professional music writers, apparently.
Well, except that side of it, I think you're being unfair because this really was an incredible performance. Like, I don't know how to convey to you that me, someone who is not that impressed by the sort of machinations and theatrics of the average giant pop performance, I was mesmerized and blown away by the power and design and success of the performance. She's an incredible presence, and it really was phenomenal to watch. So
I guess
that's where,
except,
I can't totally go
well,
with
you. But all right, so let me bring up two points. Like, one, the way that this is discussed is the same way the Super Bowl performance was discussed. And I again, facts and evidence, I'm sure it was great. I'm not here to say that it wasn't an amazing and incredible performance. But I am here to say that the Super Bowl was, like, it was good, but I'm going to guess it was not that, right? But yet we sort of talk about it all in the same way, that there's only one gear. Or this notion that I saw several times from professional music writers that this was undisputedly the best performance in the history of Coachella. Okay, maybe, but are we going to even examine the other performances? Like, the all-time greatest Daft Punk live performance, like, legendary show was at Coachella. Like, can we at least have a conversation about whether those things were or is it just like Beyonce did this and all of their history is now erased? And that's where I'm at. It's like, again, I'm sure it was really good. I'm not here to tell you it wasn't really good. I'm not here to tell you it wasn't amazing. But it always seems to go to that greatest, that extra gear where it's the greatest thing that's ever happened. It's like the way that we want to talk about things that LeBron does, where we're just kind of erasing the 85 years of basketball that came before it. And it's not to say that LeBron isn't amazing. I love LeBron. Love LeBron. You know what I mean? But I also saw Jordan, and I'm aware of Bill Russell. And you know what I mean? Like, so...
See, but I think,
or like Kobe. Well, we talk about Kobe in this way, and it's like Kobe wasn't that good.
Oh no, we don't. That's where I disagree. That I think is you selectively listening and getting angry, which I understand, and it's something I do regularly. But the conversation on Kobe is by no means glowingly positive across circles of people who actually pay attention.
Let me bring you back to this. I'll put it to you this way. Can you imagine Beyonce doing something that's not great? That's just okay.
Sure, I could. Sure. But that's not what happened.
Can you imagine anyone saying Beyonce did something that's just okay? Because I really can't.
I don't know.
And I would point out that we are talking about an artist who was several years from having a like hit you know, popular culture consciousness kind of song.
You're not counting anything from Lemonade?
No. What's the hit song from Lemonade?
Well, but I think that this, you're missing the point greatly here. I think the whole thing is Lemonade was a foundational shift for Beyonce that I think increased the level of respect she gets from people like music writers.
I mean, Lemonade was a popular drink and it still is. But I
but my point is, I don't think Beyonce had this approval rating when she was I think the Beehive was always strong. I don't think the universal acclaim from music writers was the same when she was making pop hits.
Oh, I do.
I think it's a leveling up of artistic integrity and I don't know. Integrity is the wrong word, but artistic.
A lot of ghostwriters on that record.
What's that?
A lot of ghostwriters on that Beyonce record on Lemonade. A lot of ghostwriters. No shade of Lemonade. I really like Lemonade. I feel like there's no room in the conversation to talk about its actual strengths. It's only, oh my God, this is the greatest thing that's ever happened. We're not worthy of Beyonce. And
I think you're just listening to the wrong people.
All right.
Like, I don't know. I think it's hard for me to craft the right argument for the sort of philosophical thing you're saying, because I legitimately think that both Lemonade and this performance are pretty unimpeachable.
All right. Well, look, I'm not here to impeach Beyonce, I guess.
You better not be.
I would just like, I realize in some senses this is a bit of a straw man argument. You know what I mean?
It is, because like, what is the thing you want people to criticize, I guess, would be my question.
I would just like to, can we just ask some questions about maybe whether or not this is all like wonderful? It's all 100% great.
My answer is yeah. Right now, it's great.
All right. Okay.
like that. The performance was legitimately great. I don't care about most of the songs.
Do you think it was undisputedly the best performance in the history of Coachella?
It's undisputedly the best Coachella performance I've ever watched.
Okay.
But I've never been.
All right. Well, I've been like 10 times, and I could throw in a few that I think were pretty great. Now I didn't see this one, so I'm not gonna sit here and say definitively, but like,
that's kind of my point is like, I think it's very possible that you, having seen hundreds of Coachella performances and probably having a basic top five performances in your head somewhere, I think it's entirely possible that if you had watched this, you would say, yeah, that's the best.
I guess, but I also think I'm self-aware enough to say that, hey, I haven't seen them all or I haven't seen this and I certainly haven't seen them all. And I feel like that self-awareness is not exhibited on the other side. That's essentially my problem. Yeah, I think people are saying that without having watched Coachella for like 2 years. Like, there was a lot made about the point of like, you know, Beyonce talking about how she was the first black woman to headline Coachella. And look, that's awesome. I was a little surprised that Rihanna hadn't done it before, but it turned out to be right. But that also somewhat sort of is not a story so much about Coachella's like selective dismissal of artists as what kind of festival it was when it started and how it evolved. You know what I mean? Like, there weren't any pop artists in the original Coachella. So, no, which is not, you know, necessarily an excuse for not having a black woman headliner. But, like, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a black woman who could headline a festival that wasn't working in that idiom. You know what I mean?
Well, but I think that's that may be what the conversation is intended to be about.
I think it was treated as a mere point of like representation. You know what I mean? Which is like, Coachella wasn't trying to talk to everybody for 10 of its first, you know, for its first 10, 12 years. It was trying to talk to a very selective portion of the population.
But I don't think it's a criticism of Coachella's racial bias. I think it's a criticism of an industry built on racial bias.
I don't think it had anything to do with racial bias.
You don't think that systemic racism plays a part in why there's never been a woman of color with the right profile to headline Coachella?
No, I mean, look, do I think systemic racism is a problem in the music industry? Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that's
the
all.
The specific idiom of Coachella, less so, much less so.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't think people are out here saying, finally, Coachella's not being racist anymore. I don't think that's...
I kind of think they do. And I think a lot of this was so much about a statement of like, here's Beyonce, and she's going to represent the whole of black culture and do this celebration of black culture in front of a lot of privileged white kids. And look, I'm all about that narrative. Like, I got no problem with that as an idea. It's exactly the kind of thing I love. But, like, I don't know that that is... I think it's a little bit flip about the situation and the origins of Coachella. And I also think, like, there's a whole conversation about what Coachella has been and what it should be that's worth talking about that people don't have because it's, oh, my God, Baychella, you guys. And I guess maybe that, again, is my problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more your problem than anyone else's.
I guess, yeah. No, I'm literally the only person that's thinking about this, I guess, because everyone else is just like, Queen Bee, you guys.
Well, but again, you're interpreting the raves as de rigueur and unfounded, and I don't think they are.
I'm not. No, it's my problem is not the raves. My problem is the unanimity of those raves, and just even the lack of critical thinking about it.
Lack of criticism in a particular situation does not necessarily imply lack of critical thinking.
All right. I think she's getting a rubber stamp. And which is not to say that this wasn't great, because you'd rubber stamp something that was great. But I think if it wasn't great, you'd get the same response. You get exactly the same response.
I guess I'll be more prepared to have that conversation when she does something that's not great.
Okay. Well, it'll happen sooner or later. Great. It'll happen sooner or later, and we will revisit it. That's all I'm saying.
Yes, I'm down for that. I'm here for that. You may be right when that happens. I just think right now the problem with what you're saying is that this legitimately was an unbelievable performance.
Okay. All right. I'm going
to
move on.
I mean, I'm not out here like easily and lightly declaring Beyonce to be the best performer in the world. I just don't think that's true. But I watched this thing, and it was phenomenal.
Yeah, see, I feel like you get a vote off the island for saying that, for just saying, I think it was phenomenal, but she's not the greatest performer who ever lived. What?
Yeah, well, that's fine, and if that's true, if I get voted off the island for that, then I agree that that's a stupid island. But that's not where I'm at right now. Right, now, I'm in a place where I watched a performance that was awesome, and I think it's fair to say so.
I've got a beachfront condo over on that stupid island, and when you roll your way over here, I welcome you aboard. We can play volleyball. All right.
Well, it's a great game.
It's a popular game, and it still is. we got to go soon. You want to, I think both of us have really spent the bulk of our time not watching any of these things, but watching the NBA playoffs, right?
No doubt. 40 games and 40 nights in progress.
So many games right now.
It's a beautiful thing.
It's been delightful. Biggest takeaways for you so far?
Does a takeaway have to be something I learned anew?
No, not necessarily.
Well, then I think my biggest takeaway is just a like philosophical doubling down on my view of Russell Westbrook.
Oh, this is good. We texted about this a little bit last night, and I think we're on opposite sides of this divide. I think
in a weird way we are, although I think we basically agree we have a different way of looking at it.
Yeah.
Because you texted me... I think what you said was, I have a ton of respect for Russ's game, but I just hate it. I hate his game, even though I respect his ability. And I view it the opposite way, which is, I love his game. I love watching it. I think it makes for a fun viewing experience, an interesting debate about basketball philosophy. I'm into it, but I have no respect for it because he can't see the forest through the trees, and he's, in terms of on the floor, I'm not sure I've ever seen a basketball player consistently do grievous damage to his reputation as worthwhile while thinking he's thriving. And to me, that is just, I can't respect it. Because he can't get out of his own way.
Yeah, I do think we are sort of coming at this, I guess, seeing two things, seeing the same thing two different ways. Everything that you said, I can't characterize that as wrong. I just hate, I hate watching it, I think, for the same reasons that you like watching it. He's an undeniably brilliant player. Like, there's no, like, the athleticism is incredible. He plays with the passion and fire that is undeniable. And obviously,
and unparalleled, I think.
Yeah. He's racking up numbers. He's also, he's also racking up numbers. He's racking up numbers and he's racking up numbers. He's very much intentionally racking up numbers.
Yep.
Playing around him seems to be something of a black hole in which other players tend to suffer and often thrive when they move away from him. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, he seems like he may get into a fight at any moment, in any point, in any game. And
dumb fight, by the way. A really dumb fight. And that's, again, comes back to the respect thing for me is like, the Rubio thing is the perfect microcosm of Russ Westbrook, which is Rubio just lights him on fire for a game. And after the game, after losing, he comes out and says, oh, yeah, it was way too easy for Rubio, but don't worry, I'm going to shut that shit off.
Yeah. He did not, by the way.
Well, hold on. I'll get there. But right there, already, before the next game, on its face, that comment is absurd and idiotic. You were there all night. If you were going to shut it off, why wait?
I know.
Like, what are we talking about here? That's insane. It's insane to get roasted and then act like, oh, well, anytime I want to, I can just shut it down. So that already was completely absurd and ridiculous. And again, just like, I cannot respect that take. But it became even more absurd when you see how his idea of shutting it down looks on the court. And it looks like Grayson Allen slapping the floor like an asshole at the beginning of the possession, only to either commit an idiotic foul or just lose track of his man 10 seconds later.
And you like watching this.
I think it's an incredible spectacle. I really do. And I enjoy watching Utah crap all over them. but in terms of like, but how can you respect a guy who is all like, he can't, again, he can't get out of his own way. His fury and intensity, while in some ways admirable or at least impressive, ends up being a detriment so often that I just don't know what. It's so strange to have someone that undeniably incredible, but also be like, I don't think I want him on my team, and I don't know how much he helps.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's Frank Sinatra, right? I mean, he's literally just, this is my way. This is my way to play basketball. It's the only way I know how. It's the only way I'm gonna play, and I'm too good for you to deny me. And
yeah, it's an even more extreme version of Kobe's attitude, because even Kobe found ways to make people better.
Right. Eventually. And it's all complicated by the fact that once he steps away from the basketball court, I really like Russell Westbrook.
Yeah, that's another thing.
Seems like a good dude.
In his personal life, he seems not at all overly intense or you know, obnoxiously sort of rabid. He seems like a really low-key, relaxed guy who likes chill nights at home with his wife, you know?
Yeah,
and like, in many ways, it's like, the more NBA players who want to live their life like that, the better.
Right.
You know, I much prefer Russell Westbrook off the court to James Harden getting his jersey retired at strip clubs. But you watch him, and as much as you're mesmerized and amazed, you can't help but constantly be thinking, I don't know that this is doing anybody any good.
Nope. And, you know, look, I think there's going to be a point where the first round playoff exits start to pile up where
I don't think Chris Paul gets killed nearly enough for that. So I'm not sure it ever really comes around, but
I'm not going to jump into that whole conversation because we don't have the time.
No, we don't. But Russell Westbrook's a Hall of Fame basketball player who doesn't necessarily make his team better. And that is a curious thing.
Yeah. I would argue actively doesn't make his team better.
Yeah, and it all seems to be
more takeaways for me.
Squad.
Oh, sorry.
All seem. Just the stuff that he does that hurts the team all seems to be stuff he could easily just not do. Like, it's not like there's physical limitations or you know, all his limitations are mental.
Yeah. I think for him, you know what I mean? Like, I don't think there's anything he'd easily not do. I think he
could do whatever he wants, and he does, and that's right. The problem.
I think the only way he can play the game is to do all the things.
The question is there a coach in the world who could get him to change a little bit? Because I don't think it would take much to make him one of the most positively impactful players in the league. I really don't.
Him and Pop would be an interesting experiment.
If you put someone like Pop or Brad Stevens in with him who was willing to stand in his face and tell him, no, we're doing it this way because this is how we win. And I, who knows? It could go bad, but it could also go really, really good.
I honestly don't think Brad Stevens is that guy. And that's,
may not have the clout. They would sell it in different ways. Popovich would sell it by saying, I'm Greg Popovich. You better listen to me. Stevens would sell it by saying, no, listen, let me show you why this works. Yeah. I don't know if it would work, but... But again, having a guy like Billy Donovan, who neither has the clout of Pop nor the remarkable strategic acumen of Brad Stevens, it's just, you know, it looks a lot like it did when Scott Brooks was there, which is he's trying to coach the team and Russ is making it really hard.
Yep. Yep. I think Billy Donovan's out there saying the stuff you're supposed to say.
I don't know that he's doing anything wrong or that he could do anything differently to get the team playing the way he wants to, because there are times when Paul George seems to be in control where the team really seems to click and where guys you had no respect for, like Jeremy Grant, seemed to be able to make an impact. But then Russ sometimes just grabs the game by the throat and shakes it and kind of breaks his own team.
Yeah. I think the just to switch gears, I think the chances that we can see the Philadelphia 76ers in the NBA Finals are rising quickly.
I picked them to be there, and I expect them to be at this point. When I picked it, I was pretty 50-50 with the Cavs, but I don't know how you can have any faith in that team at this point.
No.
So to me, it's not even just a matter of picking a clever, fun team to get to the finals. I've watched virtually every game of NBA playoff basketball, and I think the Sixers are the best team in the East.
Yeah, and I would say, right, that after Cleveland, the next two teams that you would pick to challenge them would be Toronto and Boston, right? There's a decent chance that neither one of them makes it out of the first round. So,
yeah, I mean, who knows what's up? Toronto is a very difficult team to process and seems to be. I wonder if they've got a little of the Thibodeau disease where they just played at such a high level in the regular season that there's no extra level to find for the playoffs. But also, they're in a tough spot with a Washington team that should not be the eighth seed. Boston's just beat up. I don't think they have a chance.
You don't think they have a chance?
To beat the Sixers or the
I thought you meant to beat Raptors. The Bucks. Sorry.
No, oh. I think there's a decent chance they beat the Bucks. They may even win this series in six. I think the Bucks are, if not the worst coached team in basketball, the second worst.
Yeah, the Bucks are a mess. The Bucks are Giannis in a mess.
Given their talent, it's remarkable how bad they are some of the time. Yeah. But as far as getting to the finals, I just think Boston's too beat up.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you got to be impressed by New Orleans. And what they've done.
Drew Holiday in particular. I mean, we knew Anthony Davis was capable of being the best player in the league at any given moment. But what Drew Holiday's done consistently on both ends of the floor has changed the entire profile of that team. And playoff Rondo sure helps.
Yeah. God, between playoff Rondo and playoff Derrick Rose, it's strange times.
Don't buy into playoff Derrick Rose. Tom Thibodeau will ruin him again soon.
I have to say, look, I am as big a Rose skeptic as there is.
Physically, he looks incredible right now.
I've watched him in person, two nights in a row. And, I mean, he's going to the basket with the kind of explosiveness that he used to, and I just never would have thought you would have seen it. Now, also, he used to, he's taking too much of the ball, taking way too many shots. But, If he's going to score like that, they're probably still going to get killed, which is exactly.
Yeah, they're going to lose. But to just tack a couple things onto that. First of all, Jimmy Butler, on some level, playing through injury, doing his best to lift a team that's poorly coached and a bunch of guys who have not maximized their potential yet, has got to be thinking somewhere in his head, seriously, I get out of Chicago with this dumb Derrick Rose disaster followed by the dumb Rondo Wade disaster, and I'm in Minnesota. I'm the team leader all year. I get hurt, and you literally go out and sign the guy who I was fighting for control with in Chicago 2 years ago. Like, give me a goddamn break. There's got to be some of that in Jimmy Butler's head.
A little bit. There's no doubt he's still the leader of this team, though.
No, I know, yeah. But Derrick Rose is taking all these shots. But just on the physicality of Rose, the thing that I think jumps out is he's doing that thing again where he looks like a running back in the lane.
Yeah.
Where he drives and just cradles the ball and Euro steps through and then explodes up to the rim. And it's incredible to watch. And, God, it's heartbreaking for me because it reminds me of what didn't happen, which is just sad.
Yeah.
And, I wish him the best, but I don't expect any consistency in the rest of his
career. No, I don't either. And I don't know how much of that will carry over to next year. And I don't know how valuable that skill is in the current NBA.
I mean, it's not that valuable. The thing that people forget about Rose is when he won the MVP as the youngest player ever to win the MVP, and I think people forget just how good he was at that point. And not just how incredibly explosive and exciting he was, but how, unlike Russell Westbrook, at that time, he was a guy who made a commitment to seeing the floor and to finding teammates and to making stuff happen for everybody. And he was making guys better. And that part of his game seems to have gone away entirely.
Yeah. that has not come back. All right. Let's...
Now he really is a poor man's Russell Westbrook, yeah. Which, I think we've done a good job of illustrating how that wouldn't be useful.
How you don't necessarily even want the rich man's Russell Westbrook.
Exactly.
All right. Let's let's get out of here. Homework wise, we had some stuff, right? What were we going to watch? We're going to watch
out a couple episodes of The British Crashing. There's only six of them, and they're like 30 minutes. You could probably watch the whole thing if you enjoy it. So I'd like to check that out. I think it's a bizarre show, but I'm having some fun with a couple episodes of it.
I can bang that out. I'm hesitant to assign Amazon homework since I still have to watch it on my iPad. But Handmaid's Tale is out, season two. I feel like we need to
get into
that. Yeah,
I think we probably got to get into that.
So we'll do that. Anything else?
I don't, Brockmire is back this week.
Oh, it is? I didn't know that. That makes me very happy. We'll definitely talk about that.
Yeah. So I think we should definitely do that. And
also your homework is also tell someone else to watch Brockmire. Cause I think very few people know about this show.
Yes. Although I don't know if you've seen the previews, but, Amanda Peet's not in them.
Ooh.
So I don't know what's going on with that, but
you know what? That first season was so good. I'm giving it some rope. Amanda Peet, no.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I'm watching it either way, but I would be disappointed if. Oh no, I guess she's still in it. That's weird though. She literally does not appear in the previews that I saw. Hmm. But it sounds like she's in it, so let's forget my weird fear about that, and I'm very excited for that show to come back, because Hank Azaria is a guy who deserves a platform.
Agreed. And you know what? This is an optional assignment. It's extra credit. If you're not doing anything tomorrow during the middle of the day, certainly if you're home, but even if you can sneak a TV at work or something, Champions League soccer, Bayern Munich and Real Madrid, who are two of the five best teams in the world, are playing in the Champions League semifinals. And this is soccer at the highest level. World Cup's coming up, and I love the World Cup. It's super fun. But if you're talking about quality of soccer, watching Cristiano Ronaldo and an elite, highly paid squad of Spaniards take on the German machine that is Bayern Munich, who also is fielding talent from all over the world, is going to be fascinating theater. It's the first of two matches, and I would recommend that highly.
While we're here, first of all, go ahead and text your boy a reminder tomorrow, because I'd like to watch that, but I'm definitely going to forget. Second of all, if you're going to start watching European soccer, might I recommend any game Dortmund is playing? because that's where you can see America's soccer star, Christian Pulisic, not in the World Cup, but he is doing things for his club team, man. He is impressive.
He is impressive. There are not too many German league games left, I don't think. So do that.
Are they not in the Champions League?
They are. I think they got knocked out of the Europa League. They were knocked out of the Champions League, kicked down to Europa, and I think they just got eliminated from Europa. So I think they're just kind of finishing out their German season right now.
Yeah. So thanks to American failure, you won't be able to watch a lot of Christian Pulisic, but to the extent that you can, I highly recommend it.
He is fun to watch, and I will say this too. This is not a quality of soccer argument. It's gotten better, but it's way, way behind. But mm-hmm. the television experience of watching an MLS game is so radically improved.
Yeah, it's true.
Really enjoyable. You watch Atlanta United or Orlando City, and like the crowds that these guys are getting and the environment in there, it's really special. And I'm stunned to see it happening in America. Like 60,000 people watching professional soccer in Atlanta is insane to me.
Yeah, apparently Atlanta finally found the team they'll show up to support.
I guess so. Oh, I had a jab.
Zing!
Damn you. Falcons game sell all the time. That's all I'm saying. All right. Let's go.
Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling. And the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.